Her anticipation for this special day had begun 3 weeks earlier, when the Kearney's advance scout had roared up to the berm gate in an armored Baja Bug. The little wag had outsized knobby tires and a roll cage around the driver's seat made of heavy pipe. Over the empty front, rear, and side window frames were hinged, blaster-proof metal shutters that could be dropped during an attack, leaving only a view slit for the driver to steer by. The Kearney scout had called himself Azimuth. A giant with cascading woolly dreadlocks, every muscle and sinew was visible beneath his glossy ebony skin. He wore a sleeveless vest of muddy coyote pelt, turned hair side out, and gray army pants tucked into the tops of scuffed and scraped, steel-toe-capped, lace-up, shin-high, black leather boots. Grimy goggles hung around his wide, muscular throat. Lilu could close her eyes and recall how the man smelled. A sweet, feminine perfume mixed with sharp body odor. Azimuth had either slathered himself with great quantities of the flowery scent, or he'd been in a prolonged fight with a gaudy slut who had. Lilu also remembered the way his front teeth were filed to points, top and bottom, and that the inside of his mouth was blood red, as was his tongue and the insides of his nostrils. Azimuth had been greeted by Bullard's most important people, including its head man, the lumbering, overweight, perpetually sweating Wilbur Melchior, who had adopted Lilu right after her ma died. The Black Giant's mission was to determine whether the Ville would be willing to pay for the privilege of seeing Gert Wolfram's world-famous Kearney show. If so, Azimuth had said, the troop would stop there for a night or so. He quoted them a steep price and water and fresh food. When asked by Melchior what the show consisted of, Azimuth threw back his head and let out a howl that startled the dirt farmers. They stepped back and grabbed for their blaster butts. But there was no threat. It was a howl of sheer exuberance. When things calmed down, Azimuth assured them that Gert Wolfram's world-famous Kearney offered genuine miracles and wonderments, gathered at great expense and hazard from the farthest corners of the Deathlands and beyond. Singing, dancing stickies, fantastical muty beasts trained to do amazing tricks, feats of Norm super strength and daring, the most beautiful Norm women this side of hell walking around in next to nothing, unparalleled exhibitions of music, comedy, and drama.
Something to tell your grandchildren, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
At that point, Melchior and the other Ville leaders withdrew to the shade of a nearby sheet metal awning and conferred. Lilu edged close enough to overhear their conversation. Her adoptive father said it was a matter of pride that Bullardville deserved this luxury. Their hosting the world-famous Kearney would indicate that the remote agricultural enclave had finally come into its own. Around the circle, heads nodded in agreement. The only word of caution came from the gaudy master, Skim O'Neill. He said there could be a big risk in letting so many strangers inside the berm at once. The protest fell on deaf ears. Melchior spoke for the rest when he bragged that Bullard wasn't afraid of anything that walked. Mopping his sweat-beaded jowls with a big cotton rag, he reminded O'Neill how they'd turned back the attempted takeovers of two different barons and chilled their secmen. A vote was taken. It was unanimous. When they returned to where the scout waited, Melchior put his hand out and told Azimuth that he had a deal. They shook on it. Then the leaders took the giant man on a guided tour. Lilu tagged along behind, unnoticed. As was common in Deathlands, the isolated Ville had sprouted up at the edge of a ruined interstate highway. The overpass that had once connected high-speed travelers with an oasis of fast food and fast gas had collapsed across four lanes of traffic the day the world changed. The center of Bullard was formed around the shambling remnants of those pre-dark fast food franchises. Their dilapidated plastic sign still beckoned. Mergen's Family Restaurant, Taco Town, Burger Extravaganza, Fish and More, which was now the Gaudy House. The four-lane highway had once paralleled a lush river valley that stretched for hundreds of miles, bordered by rugged, steep, dark mountains to the east and rolling hills to the west. The flat valley, post-nuke cost, was burned yellow, turned to dust by sun and chem rains. The slow, meandering river that had watered trees, grass, and cultivated fields decided it no longer liked the looks of things and had burrowed deep underground. Its disappearance saved Bullard from extinction, Of course, there were no more pre-breaded steaks, fish fingers, burger patties, or ice cream novelties to lure tired, hungry travelers to the ville. Yet the travelers still came, and stopped and parted with whatever valuables they had, because there was water. The underground river ran right under the town. Hand-operated pumps provided water for drinking, occasional bathing, and for travelers to take away. Grub could be had, whatever was on hand. Travelers ate whatever bushmeat the residents could chase down. Usually muty jackrabbits or snakes or birds, from sparrows to turkey vultures. These were either spit-roasted or parboiled in cauldrons made of salvaged 55-gallon oil drums. With the virtually endless supply of clean water, the ville folk grew a variety of edible crops year-round, under the shelter of metal awnings to keep off the chem rain. For fertilizer, they composted corn husks and vegetable leavings, and whatever herbivore excrement they could acquire. They cultivated beans, hot peppers, onions, and garlic. They grew corn primarily for the sugar, to make joy juice. There wasn't enough surface area inside the defensive berm to produce food for mass export, and there weren't enough people here to defend an expansion of crop growing outside the barrier. All things considered, the little hamlet was doing quite well. During the tour, Melchior hinted as much to Azimuth, but as Lilu noticed, he gave no specifics. As she well knew, Bullard's treasure was safely locked away in the basement of Mergen's family restaurant under 24-hour armed guard. Weapons, ammunition, canned food, pre-dark medicine, first aid supplies, wag fuel, oil, grease, batteries, transmission fluid, antifreeze, tires, matches, clothing, boots and chutes, hand tools, auto parts, various bits of repair material, duct tape, baling wire, nails, screws, rope, and electrical wire. There was no jolt, though. The ville leaders drew the line at hard drugs. The warehouse's contents were tangible proof of the water's worth, and anything worth more than a few drops of piss in Deathlands was worth chilling someone. Two barons had tried and failed to annex Bullardville, which stood in a disputed border zone at the edges of their respective territories. Neither baron could muster a large enough force to defeat the villagers. Every person of the age of 12 carried a loaded blaster at all times, whether working on the crops or sleeping. The youngest ones packed well-cared-for, 36-caliber, black-powder Italian reproduction Colts. They wore the 5-shot, 1862 police models and canvas, snap-flap hip holsters. The entire volunteer sec force trained regularly in marksmanship and tactics. Lilu Bunny was too young and still too frail to control a blaster that weighed more than a pound and a half, but she was very much looking forward to the day when she finally got her own blaster. After the guided tour, the leaders fed Azimuth a massive meal, got him stinking drunk, and then let him fight three women at once in the gaudy, all free of charge.
Welcome to Bullardville's famous hospitality.
I'll be sure to tell a friend, Melchior.